Welcome back, everyone. This is Nick Deolius, and you are listening to the newest episode of the Far Middle Podcast. It's early November, coming down the home stretch of 2021. I hope you got out and voted yesterday with the elections, and we'll have more to say about those in upcoming episodes. You can follow me on Twitter at Nick Deolius, and this is episode number 24 of the Far Middle. And sticking to our theme of great players or the greatest player to wear the number of our episode, when you go to 24, doesn't matter if you're throwing in hockey, basketball, football, or baseball, there is one individual that rises above the rest, and that, of course, is the Say Hey Kid or Willie Mays. You know, Willie Mays, you can sort of see his greatness and what he was as a player from a number of different perspectives. One of them certainly is just the sheer statistics. 660 home runs, over 3,200 hits in his career. For a long time, Willie Mays and Hank Aaron, I think, were the only two players to have over 500 home runs and 3,000-plus hits in their career. They were joined a little bit later by Eddie Murray, of course, with his great career. And then in the modern era, it's become a little more common. I think A-Rod's there. I want to say Pujols. Rafael Palmeiro, perhaps, was also in 500-plus home runs and 3,000-plus hits. So with the offensively-minded game and the rules changes and everything else, it's become more common. But back then when Willie Mays did that, that was saying something. In fact, only him and Hank Aaron were the two that were able to achieve it for a very long time, for decades, until Eddie Murray came along. And a 300, I think, plus batting average lifetime, 301 lifetime batting average. So his statistics sort of sum up what the individual represented on the diamond. And then the other perspective you can look at him with respect to in terms of his cumulative accomplishments is just the accolades that he collected over his career. He came in and right off the bat, Rookie of the Year in 1951. Defensively, he was an awesome player, 12 gold gloves. The catch, right, that was the one moment or play that captured his defensive genius the best. It was in the World Series against the Indians. I think it was game one. 24-time All-Star. Who plays 24 years in the major leagues, let alone as an All-Star 24 times? And a two-time MVP. He could run. I mean, he knew his way around a base pass. I think he led the league in stolen bases twice in his career. So he had it all, the complete player. I think, looking at all the great players in the history of the major leagues, I think he was number one, at least in my list. He's the top baseball player of all time. Apologies to Babe Ruth and apologies to Hank Aaron and Ted Williams and some of the others, but he was just an outstanding, outstanding talent. Another interesting thing about Willie Mays that always gets me on these great epic players, and you look at their voting into their respective Hall of Fames. Willie Mays gets into the Hall of Fame for baseball in 79, very end of the 1970s when he was done playing. In fact, I don't know if many of you know this, but he finished his career not with the Giants, but with the Mets, the New York Mets. But when Mays got voted in, he got 94% of the vote from the baseball writers, which always made me wonder. I always think about players like Willie Mays that are just epic and heads and shoulders above everybody else. Who are the 6% of the baseball writers that didn't think he should be in the Hall of Fame when they first voted to enshrine him or not? I would love to sit down with those individuals and get the backstory on just what in the world they were thinking when they were casting their vote, those 6% that said he wasn't worthy. And by the way, Willie Mays, like a lot of players from his era, 2 years in the Army during the Korean War. So also did his duty with answering the call to service for 2 years that came out of his career. A lot of people don't realize that many of the biggest stars in professional sports at the time, World War II, Korea, when they were drafted, they went and they served. So hats off to Willie Mays and a great representative for episode number 24 of the Far Middle. And episode 24 of the Far Middle is going to stick to this theme of connections, connecting dots that might seem to be discrete and separate on the surface, but actually are connected. I think for this episode, we're going to sort of keep them all within one geographic area. And I'm going to start where I began the podcast with Willie Mays, spending the bulk of his career, of course, with the Giants and in the Bay Area once they moved from New York to San Francisco. I'm going to talk about California. I recently had the opportunity to visit California, and particularly Los Angeles, the greater Los Angeles area. And it gave me the opportunity, a little bit of business that I had to conduct and some personal as well with family that's out there. But it gave me the opportunity, like most of these trips, I mentioned some of my observations from a recent trip to Washington, D.C. on a prior episode of The Far Middle. I like traveling, if nothing else, just to observe. I try to do a lot of observation when I'm out and about beyond the environs of Western Pennsylvania. And I think you learn a lot and you can contemplate a lot by just looking around, listening, and soaking it all in. So I spent some time, about 4 or 5 days, in Los Angeles. And this is, of course, one of America's iconic cities. I've always had a fascination with California, and particularly with Los Angeles and San Francisco and the larger cities since I was a kid. I don't know why that is. Never really had a connection to California physically or family-wise, but maybe it's the Western Pennsylvania, Northeast, Midwestern, and that contrast to something like California and the image that you're presented with from childhood on of what California stands for, some of it accurate, I suppose, and some of it not so accurate. I've always had this interest in it. So every time I get to go, whether it's for business or pleasure, I always try to observe as much as I can. And I got to tell you, making that trip here in the back half of 2021, it really did present itself as a great opportunity to observe. And I would sum up my trip and these different dots that will connect together in this episode in terms of what I saw out there in Southern California as, on one hand, you've got the potential that remains exponential when it comes to California and when it comes to the coastal areas of California in great cities like Los Angeles. And you also see the risks and the problems and the wall of worry that is accumulating steadily. So on one hand, you still sense this just unbridled potential and upside of the whole region and the place and everything that it's got going for it. But then you look at some of the stark realities on the ground and you just look around and get a feel for it. You just see a whole series of problems, some of them related, some of them running independently, but in parallel, that when you add them up and you accumulate them cumulatively, they just present a massive wall of worry. And we're going to talk about those in the next couple of minutes. Two observations hit me immediately before I even set foot on Californian soil. And one of them is an impression and an observation I always experience when I travel to Los Angeles. And the second one was unique to this visit for this point in time. So the one I always experience, the general one, is when you're flying into the greater Los Angeles area, when you're flying into LAX and you're coming from the eastern United States, you have this very striking transition geographically when you're looking down out of the plane window. You're flying over for basically a significant period of time, barren, completely barren desert and wasteland. No human activity, no development, no water source, nothing but just brown. And the only exception to that, of course, is the oasis of Palm Springs. When you start to approach that, which is just literally a splotch of green amidst the entire sort of area of nothing but brown desert. But then you're going from this wasteland of desert, and before you know it, you hit the San Jacinto Mountains, and you fly over those mountains, and as soon as you get over that mountain range, you go from just barren desert to what is the greater Los Angeles basin. Complete sprawl, complete development, all kinds of things going on, all kinds of infrastructure. And that impression, that observation is something that's going to hit you in the daytime and it's going to hit you at nighttime. Because when you're flying in at night into LAX, it's the same type of thing where instead of seeing brown, you see nothing but black. And then when you get over that mountain range, it goes from black to just nothing but a sea of lights. All of it, I might add, being carbon fueled or largely carbon fueled, not a lot of wind and solar that's lighting up the basin at night, despite the best intentions of California regulators. Yes, Los Angeles, it makes its impression on you before you even step foot on ground. It's just one of those types of places. But the other observation I had making the approach into LAX was a new one. And that really centers around the port of Long Beach in the greater Los Angeles area. Now, Long Beach itself is a major city, and it probably is bigger than a lot of well-known American cities in its own right. But when you look at it from the air, which I had a good chance to view this time on this trip, you see a perfect illustration of infrastructure. You see tall buildings, you see the interstates, the power transmission lines, the rail lines all threading from the inland areas to the port mouth. You see all these unloading cranes lined up in neat little rows waiting for the container ship. So if you want an illustration of physical infrastructure, you can't find a better example than the port of Long Beach. Now, this time, when I looked down there, there was a second thing that I noticed, which was lots and lots, dozens and dozens of container ships just sitting at water's edge and stringing out into the Pacific, waiting. And who knows how long they've been waiting, days, weeks, maybe in some instances longer, waiting for their cargo to be unloaded. And this, of course, goes to the whole series of bottlenecks that this nation is experiencing, and Long Beach, the port of, and particularly, has been experiencing for some time now. So I can tell you that the supply chain logjam is real. You don't need to go any further than the port of Long Beach to see it in action. And the image is a startling one because it really brings home a couple of points. First, quality of life, at least as we know it in this country, it hinges on supply chain. So all those ships and all those containers and all that logjam was reflecting quality of life that was being deterred or delayed from becoming and serving its useful purpose in the end. And that will have a big impact on a whole bunch of people beyond just the greater Los Angeles area. And it also proved a point to me, which is that you can basically tout or enjoy the best of physical infrastructure that you can think of. I mean, you can have the best roads and the best unloading facilities and the greatest ports and harbor mouths and rail and everything along that goes with it, including power generation. But to have it properly function and work, you're also going to need focused execution. And that's going to require very logical, rational, sound policy. And when you lose that, when you lose the ability to set reasonable and rational rules of the road, no pun intended, I suppose, or perhaps I did intend the pun, then you're going to never realize the potential of the physical infrastructure itself, no matter how solid it's going to be. So that logjam that I got to view from the air at the port of Long Beach, to me, it was further evidence that government matters and misguided government policies will definitely have a negative and consequential impact on the ability to execute and turn that infrastructure loose. That is going to damage the nation's supply chain. And ultimately, a damaged supply chain is going to have an impact, take its toll on quality of life. And that impact is going to not just be for the Port of Long Beach or Los Angeles or Southern California. That impact is going to stretch from sea to shining sea. And we could pick dozens of rules and regulations and nonsensical approaches to things that government has imposed on the supply chain that are all contributing root causes to where we're at today with the inefficiencies that we're experiencing. But I'll just give you one just as an illustration, which is centric to California, and that is the California truck ban, or what's referred to as the California truck ban. And what it is, it's a rule that was instituted, I believe, by the Air Resources Board in California that says that the Department of Motor Vehicles, the DMV, will not register any semi or truck in state that's older than 2011. So if you've got a semi rig that is 2010 or earlier, older than 2011, you're not going to be able to haul cargo in California. Now that, of course, reduces the supply of trucks and semis that are available to help alleviate and to help execute on our supply chain and alleviate the logjam, which only exacerbates the problems that we're experiencing today. So there's another example of just one simple but nonsensical government regulation. And why was that regulation or rule imposed? Well, of course, it's always for these altruistic, in the distant, sort of subjective things, right? The rule was adopted to, quote unquote, tackle climate change, right? How often have we heard that when it comes to rules and regulations that are just basically suffocating the ability of value creators to do what they do? What was interesting, there was a lot of discussion about this rule in California the couple days that I was there, and the advocates for the rule, and a lot of them being in the environmental movement and from government, their pushback was, I thought, an interesting one, which was when people would criticize the California truck ban and being a contributor to the problem, the response from the advocates was one of, well, that's really not a significant factor with respect to the logjam at our ports and with supply chain, because that rule has been in effect for a long time. I think the rule was implemented in 2008. So their defense of why it's not a factor is that it's a rule that's been in place for a long period of time. Well, a bad rule, whether it's been in place for a year or whether it's been in place for 10 plus years, is still nonetheless a bad rule. And if it's taking its toll on efficiencies for things like supply chain, it just will become a bigger player perhaps when those inefficiencies grow. But the fact that it's been in place for a number of years shouldn't excuse it from being viewed as a contributing root cause of what's going on with our supply chain. That was an interesting perspective of how advocates of government and environmentalists tend to view their impact of regulations and rules that they create and implement on all of us. And Los Angelinos also learned another valuable lesson the last couple of weeks, which is when you have inefficiencies in certain links or areas of the supply chain, it can lead to disruptions or damage of other pieces of the supply chain that on the surface appear unrelated, but in fact, one does impact the other. So that'll bring us to our next dot that we'll connect on this episode of The Far Middle. I'm sure a lot of you have seen or have read about the oil spill that occurred around Huntington Beach and Newport Beach, right there on sort of the Orange County, LA County border of Southern California recently. So this was an underwater oil pipeline that had ruptured, and there was an oil spill that resulted from it, and then oil was washing up and threatening sort of that Newport, Huntington Beaches area of Southern California. And of course, when it first occurred, environmentalists and the media and leftist politicians, they were quick to assign blame to what? Well, this was, you know, corporate greed, negligence of energy firms and corporations, the evil of the oil industry, all those things. And they were just another example of how profit and the almighty dollar and carbon, right, all these things are just ruining the planet and ruining pristine beaches. But, you know, before you could say sustainable, right, what happened was some facts started to come out. And it turns out that the rupture of the pipeline is now suspected to have been caused by one of those cargo ships that was waiting off port of Long Beach to unload their cargo. And it had dropped anchor when it was anchored out there in the ocean. And that anchor basically was dragging along the ocean bed floor. It caught the pipeline on the floor of the ocean and basically pulled that pipeline apart, which then discharged the oil into the water. So in some ways, right, this supply chain issue, it has the sort of intended consequences that you can imagine, not having goods and services available or as readily available as you'd like them. But they also have the unintended consequences or the unexpected consequences in this instance, which is something like the Orange County shoreline, which went through its own mini crisis and an issue that it had to address because of, once again, a series and accumulation of inept rules, regulations, policies, building upon themselves, disrupting one piece of the supply chain, which then creates stress and causes other links of the supply chain to experience issues or ultimately to break. In obvious fixes, you know, the ability to alleviate these different inefficiencies when it comes to supply chain, at least in California, it's not going to come easy. There was already a lot of debate on the airwaves and on the news out there about how any sort of changes or moves that one would want to make to increase unloading rates or truck flow to get goods to market, basically how to debottleneck the bottleneck, would have to be under sort of study, consideration. And there was also this talk of the buzzword of the need for more regulation, right? We need to regulate this more closely or more heavily. So what's that all code for? That's code for more bureaucracy. That's code for higher cost. And that is code for increased inefficiency. Those aren't things that are going to make the supply chain any better in the near term. So California's answer to this to date, when it comes to the administrative state, is that any changes we make to alleviate the problem will have to come with increased scrutiny and regulation from government. Now, I mentioned that I had business to attend to on the trip, and that required a lot of driving around the area. So like I typically do when I'm in a bigger city and I've got sort of business commitments and schedules to keep, I used a driving service to get to and from the meetings and locations, make sure you're on time, etc. And I got to confess that one of the biggest enjoyments I get out of business travel, maybe the only enjoyment that I get out of business travel, is spending the better part of a day talking to a driver as you go from location to location. And sometimes you're going to get a driver that just is more quiet and reserved, but most of the time, you're going to get one that's going to be very happy to be sociable and share their thoughts and insights. And it's coming from a true local, from someone that's living there each and every day that knows what they're talking about. So no matter where the city, you're going to learn a lot about its people and its culture by just simply listening to that driver. when you've got the opportunity to spend some time with one. And on this trip, it was one of those occasions where I had that opportunity, and the driver was awesome. We were sitting actually at the start of our day in the morning rush hour around the upscale Beverly Center. I don't know if you know about the Beverly Center in Los Angeles. It's near Beverly Hills. It's a very large upscale shopping mall, basically, that's in the middle of Los Angeles. And while we're sitting in traffic, we started to talk about what most Los Angelinos refer to as the crisis. They call it the crisis. And they are not talking about climate change, okay? What they're talking about is the homeless epidemic. And that epidemic has gone from bad to worse. It's actually getting much worse. Now, what got our conversation going while we were sitting in traffic there near the Beverly Center was, of all things, a homeless structure. And I use the word structure because this structure was somewhere between what you would consider a tent that you typically see with, unfortunately, a lot of homeless encampments across the country, and a house. It was somewhere in between. It was a rectangle in shape, and I'd say, you know, the length of this was about 30 foot long, so it ran a significant length along the sidewalk, and it basically took up the entire width of the sidewalk itself. So this ran from the curb of the street to about within 2 foot of the wall of the mall of the Beverly Center itself. So it left you about 2 foot for pedestrians to pass alongside. It was very tight across the width of the sidewalk. And the height of this thing was probably about 6 foot. So, you know, someone like myself could stand up, but if you were really tall, you'd have to maybe hunch over a bit, but it was a pretty decent height. And there were windows that were cut out with respect to the structure. It had lumber studs on the corners and alongside the lateral lengths to give it some structure and some stability. And there was even a hibachi and some lawn furniture on the side of it that basically served as an impromptu patio. So this sort of got our attention, the driver and myself, because, you know, A, it was a larger structure, and B, not typical for what you see with the homeless epidemic and the human crisis that goes with it. In some ways, it was actually a pretty impressive display of human ingenuity, again, reflecting, unfortunately, a human quality of life crisis that's afflicting the nation, not just Los Angeles. So the driver and I are sitting there, we're basically admiring the workmanship that went into the structure. And while we're sitting there in traffic, here comes a police vehicle. And I asked the driver, I said, do you think the police vehicle is going to approach the resident here and make the move? And the driver just laughed and says, no, the police aren't going to do anything about that. He says, I think I know where they're going. And sure enough, light changed. We moved up a bit, crept up to the next intersection. And there was a Starbucks. And at the sort of right side, right lane of the road, there were two very expensive vehicles parked there with their flashers on. I guess the occupants ran into Starbucks to get their latte or whatever they were ordering. One was a Porsche, one was a Range Rover. And the police vehicle pulled up behind them, put on their sort of siren alarm. And when they saw that, the officer saw that there wasn't occupants in the vehicles, got out and started to write them up tickets. Now, what was interesting about that 30 to 45 seconds from when we saw the structure of the homeless individual, the police vehicle, and then what was going on at the Starbucks half a block up, so much of that really summed up and reflects the reality of modern day Los Angeles and a lot of major American cities. First, you saw extreme poverty rubbing right up against extreme wealth. I mean, the most drastic of turns, from a homeless individual literally didn't have a place to live and was trying to build what they could literally on the sidewalks of the Beverly Center, to people driving Porsches and Range Rovers, jumping out of their cars and ordering high-end and high-priced coffee products in Starbucks. You've also got this contrast of police who are today enforcing some laws and ignoring others, right? So there's this subjectivity that's been creeping into rules. Rules used to be rules and laws were laws. You didn't break any. And if it was a bad rule or law, then you changed it. But that's not the case anymore. There are some laws that are enforced and others that are not. That creates a very confusing world for a lot of stakeholders in areas like Los Angeles. And then the other thing is that you saw, to me at least, everyone in that city, in that morning rush, just going about their daily routine, impervious to everything. So the homeless epidemic, the structure blocking the sidewalk, the police pulling up on a Starbucks, people just parking their Porsches and Range Rovers and high-end vehicles on the right lane of the road and not caring what the impact is. And frankly, the rest of the motorists that just sort of went around them, not thinking twice about it. All this was just eerily normal for everyone involved, which I found to be strange. And I think the most depressing thing of all that I had as a takeaway is that, to me, that meant that there's just this growing acceptance, and particularly a growing acceptance that homelessness, it's unsolvable. It's an unsolvable problem. It's here to stay. That's why the homeless are building sturdier and sturdier structures. They're building them to last longer. That's why no one bats an eye. No one thinks twice. Everybody feels bad about it, I suppose, but there's just this sense that that residents and people in our biggest cities are just accepting homelessness as something that's here to stay, unaddressable, and not going away anytime soon. And that, I think, is tragic. And you can file this one under the category of you can't make this stuff up, because literally 5 minutes after this series of events that we observed happened, and we're still, by the way, after those 5 minutes in the same intersection, still trying to get through that same traffic light, but 5 minutes later, we had the radio news on, and the newscaster in the car informed us that LA City Council, now that's that very enlightened board with a lot of wisdom and foresight, not, right? LA City Council voted recently to ban homeless encampments across a couple of city districts. I'm not sure which ones they were, but I think there were three in total. And they were going to ban these homeless encampments within 500 foot of schools and libraries. So they picked sort of three sections of the city, and they said, if there's a homeless encampment within 500 foot of a library or a school, we're going to ban those, and we're going to shut those down and move them out, basically. That sort of added up to over 50 sites that would be affected. But what was interesting was the newscaster told us that the 50 or so reflected just about half of the locations that were under original consideration for the homelessness ban this summer. So not sure how they went from, say, 100 or just over 100 down to just over 50. I'm sure there was a lot of subjectivity involved in that, but that's what they disclosed in the newscast. And the rule itself for these 50-some-odd encampments or locations will be enforced in 2 weeks' time. There's going to be signs that will be put up that are sort of posted and either warning of what's coming or the rules, how there's no homeless allowed in this zone or area. And the signs themselves that they're going to post are going to cost in the aggregate $2 million, about $2 million bucks. So the driver, you know, we were listening to this, and again, it was very timing interesting, but the driver listens to this and he says, you know, I am confident that this move from our illustrious city council is not going to improve the homeless situation in any way, shape, or form. In fact, it might make things worse. That was sort of his prognosis. And then, you know, he sort of concluded with the obvious statement of $2 million for signs. Can't we put that to better use if you're really interested in addressing the homeless epidemic? And I agreed with him, of course, but then I sort of put in my two cents saying, but you're thinking of this the wrong way. You're looking at this from the perspective of the homeless and from the perspective of the taxpayer and from the perspective of the resident of Los Angeles. Think of this from the perspective of the government bureaucrat and the administrative state. You know, from that perspective, from that stakeholder's vantage point, this makes all the sense in the world, because this process has to be administered. It has to be managed. You're going to need to hire more bureaucrats. You create job security. It's a windfall for government and the bureaucracy. And he just sort of laughed and he said, I didn't think of it that way, but now that you mention it, more and more of what I see going on in the city of Los Angeles can be explained by what you just summed up. And this whole sort of observation and what the newscaster was talking about when it came to LA City Council and how they were going to solve homelessness connects us to our next dot for this episode of The Far Middle, which interestingly has to do with baseball and government, or the sort of expert class of government. So this trip during late October was also coincided with the National League Championship Series. The Dodgers were playing the Atlanta Braves. And although I didn't go to the games, I was able to watch them on TV. There were three games when I was out there that were in Los Angeles. The Dodgers hosted three games in a row in the series. And I've been a lifelong Dodgers fan. They're second in my heart only to my hometown Pirates. I loved the Dodger teams of the 70s and the early 80s. I just thought they were awesome. And to me, Dodgers and Chavez Ravine at Dodger Stadium, that is one of those early impressions of California that I spoke about at the start of the Far Middle podcast for this episode that hit me at a very young age. So I just equate Dodger baseball to the whole California vision and Californian feel. So the Dodgers crowd, you know, for these three games were true to form. They're just they're notorious for being fashionably late. The first couple innings of the game, it looks like the stadium's only two-thirds full. By the time you get to the seventh or eighth inning, the stadium's packed. But what was interesting, and why I wanted to bring it up for our podcast, was that there were medical experts on the news throughout those couple days that were talking about how cheering and chanting at sports venues can increase the risk of spreading or being infected with COVID. They're basically saying don't cheer during sporting events because it increases the risk that you'll contract COVID, which wasn't something that I had expected or I had thought about, but nevertheless, there they were on the airwaves warning against cheering for your team at a sporting event. And from what I could tell from the TV broadcast, nobody was listening to these so-called experts at the actual games themselves. Well, this brings us now down the home stretch of this episode of the Far Middle Podcast. We've covered a lot with respect to those observations of Los Angeles. We started with that physical contrast flying into LAX from barren nothingness into urban sprawl divided only by a mountain range. And then we talked about how the Port of Long Beach from the air is the physical example that you would expect of infrastructure at work, and how all that great physical infrastructure can lead or add up to nothing if it's coupled with inept policy, regulation, and government, things like the California truck ban, and how increasing scrutiny and regulation of government and politicians is probably going to make our supply chain issues worse, not better, despite all that physical infrastructure. We pivoted over to another thing that bad policy is impacting, which is homeless and a homelessness epidemic in cities like Los Angeles, and how it's increasingly being viewed by all parties, by citizens and taxpayers, police, government, the homeless themselves, is something that's permanent and unaddressable, and what a tragedy that is, and how you're seeing that view being manifested by the homeless themselves when they're building more and more permanent structures because the assumption behind it is that they're not going anywhere anytime soon, and how, again, government and government entities like LA City Council are actually making things worse when it comes to the homeless epidemic. And then we pivoted over to that expert class in government, in the bureaucracy, and how they get into all kinds of strange things and views and positions on areas far afield like sports and sporting events, and how their view and their message recently across Los Angeles of cheering at professional sporting events can increase the risk of contracting COVID or spreading COVID, and how normal people listen to that, shrug their shoulders, and go about doing what they're doing. And by the way, on the issue of COVID and pandemic and everything else, I'm increasingly, I don't know about you, but increasingly I'm sort of coming to the position where I can sum up my view of being pro-vaccine and anti-mandate. I think that's the way to summarize my views on COVID and mandates and vaccines and everything else. Pro-vax, anti-mandate. And we'll see how that evolves over time here, but that's sort of where my head is at currently. Now, believe it or not, we've got a second slate of observations to share about Los Angeles, but we're going to save those for our next episode of the Far Middle Podcast, which will be episode number 25. So this represents the first in the history of the Far Middle Podcast series, our two-part podcast to address an issue, and that's very exciting that we're going to have a two-part series. What are we going to talk about next week? Well, I can tell you there'll be exciting observations, but we're going to have to save them. You're going to have to listen next week as to what they are and what we'll cover. Hey, one comment for you. If you are traveling to Los Angeles in the near future and you're looking for something interesting to do, and if you're interested in rock and the history of rock music, I've got a suggestion for you, and that is to spend half a day or so exploring the Laurel Canyon area and the streets off of Laurel Canyon and the Hollywood Hills. A lot of music history was made in those hills and in those streets. You had groups through the 60s and 70s, the Mamas and the Papas, Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young. You had the Doors. I think Jim Morrison lived up in the Laurel Canyon area for a while. Some of the Beatles, Ringo Starr for sure. I want to say maybe even John Lennon for a while was up there. The Eagles, Jackson Brown, Joni Mitchell, all of them were making music history in Laurel Canyon and off of Laurel Canyon in the Hollywood Hills. So do some research before you head out there to see sort of what houses and streets you'd want to check out. It's all available on the internet. But a lot of music history, some really great sight lines of Los Angeles up in the Hollywood Hills there. And start your trip there on Sunset at the Chateau Marmont, which has its own unique and longstanding history. Obviously, probably best known for where John Belushi met his demise, but a lot of other history, a lot of it music history at the Chateau. You can start right there and then drive up Laurel Canyon and check out some of those streets and where some of that history was made. Well, until next week, you can follow me on Twitter at Nick Deolius. The book Precipice is coming out in January 22. You can pre-order that now. If you go on the nickdeolius.com website, you can find the links to the Amazon pre-order, Barnes & Noble, as well as Indie Books. I encourage you to do that. And until then, until next week in episode 25, stay safe. Talk to you soon.